We are here to convene in the newly constituted Northern Panel. I'm pleased to be a part of that with my colleagues, Justice Gibbons and Justice Pickering. We'll begin this morning with case number 63175, Secured Assets, Belvedere Tower versus Davis. Mr. Anderson, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, we are. I believe that Ms. Lee has some housekeeping issues to address with the court, if we may, before we start oral argument.
Certainly. Does it have to do with the settlement, or at least the partial settlement in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sylvia Lee on behalf of Belvedere Towers Owners Association's co-appellant. Yesterday with the respondent, U.S. Bank, we did reach a resolution of our issues. Our intention is to present a stipulated order of dismissal of our appeal. I don't imagine that that will take longer than a week or so, but our intention is to withdraw from this appeal.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And if I may be excused then, Your Honors.
Well, you may.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor, counsel, honorable justices, may it please the court. My name is Dane Anderson. I represent Secured Assets Belvedere Tower on this appeal. And for ease of reference throughout this argument, I may refer to them as SABT. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Just so that you understand, the clock in front of you does not reserve the time separately. So when you get down to your 4 minutes, that's your 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
This case involves a claim for excess proceeds arising from a tax sale following a sale conducted by the Washoe County Treasurer with regard to 92 condominium units at the Belvedere Towers in Reno. My client submitted a claim for those excess proceeds based on a receiver certificate that was issued in a receivership action pending before Judge Barry in Washoe County. There are two issues that I need to address with the court today in order to persuade you that my client's position is correct. The first involves whether SABT is eligible to recover excess proceeds under NRS 361585. And the second is, if they are eligible, what is the priority of payment of those proceeds? I'm going to start with the priority issue because if I don't convince you that the receiver certificates have priority, then whether we qualify under NRS 361585 is moot. Our position is that the district court erred in finding both that the receivership certificates did not have priority and that SABT's receivership certificate did not qualify under NRS 361585. The Treasurer did not apply the statute as written because if it had, it would have paid SABT's receivership certificate both as a mortgagee under a mortgage or secondly as a judgment creditor under a judgment. Hitting on the issue of priority, the district court cited the case of Irving Bank versus district court in holding that a receivership steps into the shoes of the owner and is subject to all existing liens that are given in good faith. And I agree with that general proposition as a matter of law. In this case, U.S. Bank did have a deed of trust given some 2 years earlier for $32 million on the subject property. The Irving case, however, involved a set of circumstances in which the judgment creditor that was being subordinated had been given no notice of the proceedings, had been given no opportunity to be heard, yet the court in that case subordinated their judgment. And the Nevada Supreme Court, this court, held that that wasn't proper. In our case, we have an entirely different set of circumstances. U.S. Bank had its deed of trust in 2006, and in 2008, it came to the court and said, we want a receivership appointed over this property. In doing so, with knowledge of their priority lien, they drafted, or their predecessor first drafted, and then they confirmed, an order appointing receiver that said, receivership certificates will be a lien of first priority on the property, and will be paid prior to all other existing liens.
And what page of the record precisely is that language that you just paraphrased?
Your Honor, if I may.
Yes. It's obviously the order adopting or appointing receiver, but it's a long order.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's paragraph 18 of the order appointing receiver at page joint appendix 351. And if you go to the, I'm sorry, it starts at 351 and goes to the middle of page 352. And if you look at line 12, it says, all funds loaned to the receiver pursuant to receivership certificates shall be deemed a lien of first priority, which shall be repaid prior to all other encumbrances and claims other than the cost of administration of the receivership estate. I don't believe that there's any issue that all those expenses were paid. And so the first lien and priority are these receivership certificates. And not just SADTs, but U.S. Bank had the first five receivership certificates and then also the seventh receivership certificate that was issued after the receivership proceedings were closed, or after the court entered its order ratifying and terminating the receivership.
Wasn't the purpose of the receivership, though, to secure money for U.S. Bank as the first trust deed holder and the default under NRS 107080, and therefore to make sure that their collateral was protected?
Well, I believe that the purpose of the receivership is to preserve the property while any issues involving the property could be worked out. If you look at receivership certificate number 6, it was funded to pay for a boiler lease and to pay the Nevada energy bill to prevent the property from being shut down. Did it benefit U.S. Bank? Absolutely. And U.S. Bank is the one that went to the court and said, we need this in place. And I think Judge Barry at some point in the record below pointed out to counsel that U.S. Bank's purpose in doing so was to try to establish a priority over some subcontractors that were making priority claims at that time. But I agree with Your Honor that U.S. Bank did have first priority when the receivership started, but by consenting to and drafting the order appointing receiver, it subordinated its deed of trust just to the limited extent of the receivership certificates that were issued. I think they total, in principle, roughly $550,000. And so I'm not sure if I'm answering Your Honor's
question. Well, I understand what happened. So.
Right. And so the point of all this is that the Irving case, which the district court relied on in saying that SABT was behind U.S. Bank's deed of trust and priority, is completely factually inapposite. And U.S. Bank, in doing what it did to benefit itself, it waived its priority under the deed of trust. And I would argue that the order appointing receiver and the priority in which it established is res judicata as to all subsequent proceedings.
But that order, as to other existing lien holders, did not subordinate their interests. I mean, U.S. Bank may be wherever it is, but I'm unclear on how this receivership order could have subordinated funds advanced, as you're hypothesizing, and have a first priority lien, notwithstanding all the others who had liens against property.
And, Your Honor, I'm not sure which other liens may have existed on the property.
Well, you just said that U.S. Bank did this to gain some advantage over junior lien holders.
I'm sorry, right, over the subcontractors. Judge Barry, during the oral argument of this matter, referenced that all these subcontractors were participants in the proceedings. Any parties that had notice and an opportunity to be heard in that proceeding would be subject to Judge Barry's ruling of priority. And in any event, none of those claimants were claimants for the excess proceeds. The only parties that submitted claims for excess proceeds were Secured Assets Belvedere Tower, U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank submitted both a claim based on its deed of trust and on its receivership certificates, and then BTOA, which has now resolved its case.
Well, BTOA, I assume, they resolved under SFR. They'd be entitled to 9 months super priority under NRS 116.3116. Your client, though, was not in the same position as the Homeowners Association.
No, it's not in the same position. It's not claiming under that super priority statute. It's claiming under a court order, which I have argued is both a judgment under NRCP 54 and also a mortgage. We're a mortgagee under a mortgage, and I'd like to address that portion of it before we run out of time here. The Topaz Mutual Company case versus Marsh is a case I've cited repeatedly in briefing. And in that case, the court held a mortgage is usually considered to be a nominal conveyance held in abeyance of certain property as security for the payment of a certain debt. If the parties intend to create a mortgage, no particular form of instrument or words is necessary to create an equitable mortgage. I think what the court, what the treasurer and what the district court did in this case is said, your receivership certificate does not have the title mortgage. It does not have the title judgment. It says receivership certificate, and that doesn't appear in NRS 361-585, and therefore you're not eligible. I think in doing that, both elevated form over substance, because if you look at the receivership certificate, it refers to specific collateral, the 92 condominium units. It's for a specified amount to be paid to MMBC, and now my client, and to accrue interest at 8%, and it was pledged against that property and was recorded in Washoe County as a lien against the property.
So no ambiguity in the statute as far as you're concerned?
As far as I'm concerned, SABT qualifies as a mortgagee under a mortgage or a judgment creditor under a judgment. If the court finds that those terms are ambiguous and we don't directly or clearly qualify, then perhaps mortgage and judgment may be ambiguous, in which case we'd have to go look at a legislative history as to what they intended.
You're drawing that status solely from the face of your receiver's certificate, is that correct?
We're drawing the status as a mortgagee under a mortgage based on what the receivership certificate is, which is a pledge of the real property to secure the payment of the $200,000 that my client advanced, or my client's predecessor advanced against the property. The Flage versus Flynn case, 63 Nevada 201, holds that the form of writing is not important provided it appears that there was intended to create a security. So my position is that although it doesn't say so, the receivership certificate is indeed a mortgage.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Conrad?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I appreciate your attendance here today and to consider the issues on this appeal. I will start off by pointing out a couple issues which I believe make the decisions of both the treasurer and the affirmation by the district court, which was essentially sitting as a court of appeal in this case, the right decisions based on the statutes and the law that applies to this case. First and foremost, I think, as the court has just pointed out and looked at the record in the order, the linchpin of what they are trying to argue as the basis for their super priority legal authority, as it were. There's no statute, there's no case law that allows a receivership certificate to have super priority over third parties or any other lien holders. What they are entirely relying on is certain wording in a receivership order. And that order, although Mr. Anderson would continually used to say it was a lien on the property, it was actually a lien on the receivership estate, which is distinct from the property that was defined in the deed of trust and was ultimately sold by the Washoe County Treasurer. If you actually look at the receivership order as well, Section 2 defines all the property that goes into the order, its rents, its other income. The receiver had authority to sell units in the receivership in order to raise money, and there was a distribution scheme set forth in that order. If and when money came into the receivership, it could be distributed out according to this line of priority. And in that line of priority, the court said we're going to pay the administrative expenses first, receivership second, and so on and so forth. If you actually look at the receivership certificate number 6, which is, the again, the core document they're relying which they would like to consider as a mortgage or a judgment in this case. In the last, very last paragraph of that receivership number certificate six, it says this is a debt of the receivership estate. Well, that's exactly what it is, Your Honor. It's a debt of the receivership estate. And what happened to the receivership estate in this case? It terminated. It terminated in the summer in June of 2009. And in fact, the reason it terminated was because there was not enough funds in the entire receivership to keep the receivership going. And in fact, my client had to advance monies to pay the final bills of the receiver, etc. So essentially, what we have here is an order that says, look, we're going to allow a receiver to come in, protect certain property, try to earn money from that property, whether it be rents, selling the property, and we're going to set up an estate, a receivership estate with all those assets. And if and when monies come in, we're going to set a priority of how to distribute that. Well, all that happened, there was not enough money in the estate, and eventually it had to be closed down. If any claimants of the receivership certificates had any claimants, it was to the out-of-state, and they should have made that clear in front of the receivership court in 2009, not several years later after Treasurer has posted and conducted a sale of real property. And with that understanding, it's really, do you look at what piece of property was affected by that order? It was not all third-party lien holders to a certain piece of real property as recorded in the recorder's office. It was merely that receivership estate. And that's made clear from the face of the receivership certificate, which said it was a debt of that estate. And to make even this even clearer, if you look at the actual statutes of what
the same thing. Before we get to the statute, sure. To me, I mean, as a legal proposition, it would seem that a lender in U.S. Bank's position could agree that they would subordinate so that the receivership could get funds in order to do whatever the receiver was going to do. And if you had a clear subordination agreement, that would be one thing. You're saying you don't, but I'm not so clear why this is not purely a documentary issue rather than a statutory one. Surely the PAC statutes would not stop a receiver from getting a first priority position if everybody agreed to that on a loan that was undertaken to operate the receivership and hopefully bail everyone out, similar to a bankruptcy reorg. I mean, what would be wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, if U.S. Bank did intentionally subordinate its loan, you are absolutely correct, a lender, any other lien holder, can intentionally subordinate its loan to another interest.
Right.
But that doesn't exist here.
But if it did, then that would have priority, and presumably the tax people should pay that as, would they be the successor to the owner probably at that point? I don't know.
Yes. Well, for example, in a usual receivership situation, oftentimes a lender will advance monies. There's typically terms in a deed of trust where those protective advances relate back to the original deed of trust. You don't get into this priority issue. Here you have a third party who was trying to fund a settlement that benefited certain guarantors and other folks. And because that third party advanced funds, they are now claiming, oh, well, we want to get paid. So you're absolutely right. But as you point out, there is no record in this case of any subordination, waiver, or intentional relinquishment of any right by U.S. Bank in order to do so.
But then it's not for this court to write some opinion on the statute and what the statute means, which really didn't address a true subordination. Rather, for me, the most productive thing would be to establish why these documents don't establish that kind of subordination arrangement.
Your Honor, I think while that is correct, the statute, as interpreted by the treasurer, which is forced to, the treasurer is forced to, after every property sale, to distribute excess sale proceeds. It doesn't have any discretion in accordance with a certain.
Right, but it can pay them into court on an interpleader and have the court sort it out. Right?
Well, the statute is mandatory. I presume that's a possible remedy for the treasurer. But in this case, the treasurer followed the statute as written. And I think the statute as written is clear. So
you would hold, even if there were an express subordination, and I'm not saying there is in this case, but you would hold that would be a legal impossibility for a receiver in that position under this statute.
I think that would create an a much stronger argument of estoppel waiver, et cetera, against the lender if they knowingly relinquished a right. It's just like if I contractually agreed to relinquish a right, how can I, even if a statute says I'm entitled to it, if I relinquish that statutory right, then I did so.
Right. But, I mean, I think we have to allow the treasurer to, I mean, to read the statute to say that's an impossible commercial transaction seems to me to be a bit of a reach. You may persuade my colleagues differently.
Okay. Thank you. Going, again, my time.
Counsel, let me ask you, so the secured assets, Belvedere Tower, loan money, how did their claim come about? They loaned money to finance costs of this receivership or what?
Well, Your Honor, the receivership case, again, I was not a party of. It was a separate case several years before this case arose. It's my understanding that there were certain funds needed to do certain things to fund a settlement. If you look at the certificate itself, it identifies a settlement and some utility fees, and those fees were volunteered by the predecessor of the SABT to resolve some issues.
Which was who? I mean, why did they do that?
Again, not being part of the original proceeding, what I understood from my reading of the record was the settlement that was ultimately funded by this benefited guarantors of the underlying entity that assigned the assets to SABT. Okay. And I'm not sure, I don't know, and I don't want to misrepresent, but typically utility funds which are being funded, there's also bonds and other things. So there was, I don't know all the details, but there were may have been some interests of the defendants at that time saying, look, we want to take care of these problems. Let's do it this way.
Okay, thank you.
Given the time thing, one of the things I really want to make sure is important too is even assuming you consider the certificate of mortgage, which I don't think it is, or a judgment, which I don't think it is, but assuming argument you adopt those positions, you can't change time. And that is really what they are asking you to do in here. That certificate came into existence 3 years after the recordation of the deed of trust. The priority schedule in the statute makes simply clear that if you have to, unless there's a known relinquishment, as you were suggesting as a possibility, which doesn't exist in this case, but you can't, even if this judgment existed, this mortgage existed and was created out of the receivership certificate, it would still post-date the deed of trust in this case.
Your point is, even with the court order, if U.S. Bank hadn't signed a written subordination agreement, it's still in first position.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
You have 5 more minutes if you want.
Your time is not up, sir.
I'm sorry.
You don't need to stay. Maybe if you're done.
Sorry, I heard the beep, and I thought the 5 minutes was for him. I guess a couple other points I would, given I have a couple more moments. I think, and again, it's raised by the treasurer in its brief. There's solid case law dealing with the interpretation of statutes where if things are not in a list of items, they're presumed to be intentionally left out, or as under the Latin term, which I'm not going to even try to articulate because my Latin is terrible, the doctrine of that which is enumerated exclude that which is not, you know, the exclusio doctrine. And I think perhaps the most important thing that we have here is I've heard counsel talk about the Irving National Bank case, as, well, it's distinguishable because the parties didn't have notice of this or that. That does not detract from the core principle of law which the court relied on in our case, which is the receiver cannot divest a prior lien holder of their rights taken in good faith. And that's exactly what they're trying to do here, which is the receiver takes what they have, and they can't go in and they can't judicially, unless there's consent, go in and just divest a prior lien holder of their lien rights. And that's exactly what they're trying to do here. This was a debt of a receivership estate to pay for certain bills. There was no known waiver, intentional relinquishment of any rights whatsoever. And now what they're trying to do is you know, using some vague language in a receivership order to bootstrap their way into a priority position, which they shouldn't and would never have gotten an agreement to. So, Your Honors, unless there's any further questions, I'm happy to.
What would be helpful for me is if you could address the language that your opposing colleague read to us from the order appointing the receiver on page 13 of that, and I think you've covered it.
Yeah.
But for me, the turning point in this case is, did your client agree to subordinate its first deed of trust to funds advanced or borrowed by the receiver and embodied in a receiver certificate? And why is that not an accurate reading of this document?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at this exact sentence that he read it, and I apologize, I have poor eyesight, but and this is a very poor copy of the order.
It is. It's a difficult
one. It says, all funds loaned to the receiver pursuant to the receivership took shall be deemed to be a lien of first priority, which shall be repaid prior to all other encumbrances and claims other than the cost of the administration of the receivership estate. Now, what cannot be disputed from that sentence is how it is interpreted. The magic language of first priority are connected with the terms of the receivership estate, claims, other things. They're clearly talking in this sentence about, if we're going to administrate a receivership estate, it's going to be administrated in the following way. There are no claims. If this was really a sentence that created a lien priority against any and all other holders of any rights out there, that they record and therefore fall into the statute, then there would be no reason for the words receivership estate to be there. There would be no reason to talk about claims, because claims are inchoate unless they're in part of a receivership context, as it were. So clearly, if you look at that, it really does provide simplified and actual context that this was really talking about prioritizing claims within an estate.
What about the word encumbrances, though? It says, which shall be repaid prior to all other encumbrances and claims. I'm sure that he will stand up and lean on that word.
I assure you, Your Honor. And, you know, if you look at the rest of the receivership order, the receiver has broad duties. There's many encumbrances upon an estate, a receivership estate, especially in this one where you're administering 52 condominium units. There's going to be bills. There's going to be mechanics liens. There's going to be other things that have to be addressed within that receivership estate. The process for doing that is within the receivership itself. And to go ask the court to say, look, if they really thought that they were entitled to that, then they should have said, Your Honor, there's assets in the receivership estate. Those should be sold to pay my claim or my dollars. And they didn't do that. There was no money, and the receivership was closed without any further discussion on that point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Anderson, you have 3 minutes and 56 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that the language that is a debt of the receivership estate is accurate. The sentence that he was referring to, I think the purpose of that was to clarify that the receiver, in this case himself, would have no personal liability arising out of acts conducted within the scope of his receivership. It didn't mean that the receivership estate couldn't provide a lien against its property. If you look at the first page of certificate number 6 at JA-327, it says, the receivership estate assets include Belvedere LLC's collateral assets comprised of real and personal property located at 450 Arlington in Reno. So the receivership estate had property. And in this case, they granted a lien against that real property. Receivership certificate number 6 contains a legal description of each and every condominium in that 92-unit group.
Right, but isn't it a more reasonable reading that these documents were from the date of the receivership forward and didn't rearrange existing priorities and secure debt against the property?
I don't think that's fair, Your Honor. I think that, unlike Irving, U.S. Bank came in and said, we have this deed of trust. We know we have this deed of trust. But in order to get priority over potential other claimants, and at this point in time, they're having a battle with the subcontractors, We asked the court to reprioritize these liens and any money advanced from this point on out in this receivership proceeding to preserve the property, including boilers and heating and other power necessary to maintain the property. We're going to give priority to this limited extent. And U.S. Bank itself advanced money and claimed receivership certificates.
But it had a future advances clause, or a clause in its deed of trust, presumably, that said if it needed to protect the property, it could advance money and add that to the deed of trust.
I believe so, Your Honor. I know that the deed of trust provided for receivership proceedings, but that doesn't mean that a party can't waive its rights under the document.
I agree that it could, but where did it?
Specifically, I think that's the question that we're troubling.
Right, and I acknowledge
that. Where is that specific waiver of their rights?
I'm sorry to interrupt.
And why would they waive them, I guess?
Right. I think, as pointed out, at that point in time, they were having a battle with the subcontractors as to whether there had been construction performed prior to the deed of trust being executed or recorded. And in that case, Judge Berry acknowledged in the record, I don't have the specific citation at this point, that U.S. Bank, I think she said, quite cleverly came in and organized this receivership such that they would have priority over other potential lien holders. So I think if, and I can get those citations for the court if it wishes, but I think if you read that, she understood that what U.S. Bank was trying to do was trying to protect its loan while at the same time advancing money to preserve the property, but they didn't want it to be subject to that deed of trust. They didn't want it to be behind potentially the mechanics lien, which I think is ultimately what happened in a different proceeding. And so they agreed to change the priority and allow these specific advances to come first. And I think that's a waiver by conduct. I think it's res judicata in the order appointing receiver that subsequent proceedings are bound by, including the distribution of tax proceeds. I'd like to quickly refer the court to the supplemental appendix that I filed. It's a document that U.S. Bank filed shortly before the tax sale, in which it acknowledged that the lien was on the real property. It said on page 2 supplemental appendix page 4, it referred to the collateral securing the certificates as real property. And if you look at page 9 of the supplemental appendix, it says secured assets correctly states that certificates were given first priority on the collateral. I think that's a judicial admission and confirms the waiver previously given. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. This matter will stand submitted.